Good morning. Welcome to Shattering Myths, the program devoted to those of you who realize, or at least open to the realization, that all of the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt and counterproductive. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us over the next 2 hours, is 877-376-45. I want to pick up where we left off with the story that was published by the New York Times, because it points out a number of things. The first of those is that the New York Times, which is considered the best newspaper in America, the home of the best journalist in America, did a horrific job of demonstrating proper journalism and of reporting a story truthfully and accurately. And second of all, the story is, in my opinion, from my perspective, among the most important stories that can be told today. And third, I would like to reemphasize why it is important to hate. And I understand that hate speech is the anathema of political correctness, and that sites like YouTube have posses that rove around looking for hate speech that they can remove, when in fact, many of our problems today are the fact that we do not hate those things which are destructive and damnly and injurious, especially to our children.
Is it really a bad thing to hate something that hurts people?
According to most politically correct sites, like, for example, YouTube, if you post a video that is hateful of a religion, even though that religion is undeniably responsible for encouraging men to sexually abuse little boys and little girls, to kidnap them, to enslave them, to behead them, to torture them, and even though its own doctrine undeniably, irrefutably, encourages these behaviors, it's evidently inappropriate to hate those things, and therefore, I guess it's more loving to speak on such doctrines' behalf so that they can brutalize and rape and sodomize more and more children.
I guess I could say then that I hate people that think hate's not an acceptable thing to feel.
Yeah, I would say that if you do not engage in hate speech against those things that are perverted and demonic and despicable and destructive and deadly, that there's something wrong with you, that you've lost your conscience, that you've lost the ability to be moral, and that you are every bit as big a part of the problem as are the perpetrators of these heinous acts.
Well, you're saying to hate things that people, choices that people make. You have a choice to be a Muslim. You have a choice to be thing. You're not, you're not doing something stupid and railing against a race.
Right. No, and I have no issue with free will. In fact, I encourage free will. I'm never going to hear me criticize the ability to choose. What you will hear me criticize is doctrines, political doctrines, religious doctrines, military doctrines, media doctrines that are deceitful, destructive, counterproductive, and particularly those that take advantage of, prey upon, the most defenseless members of our society. And when you fail to act in a judgmental way, and you fail to ascribe the only common denominator between 99% of terrorist acts, beheadings, tortures, pedophilia, rape, kidnapping, and enslavement, and you do not make the common denominator known, and you fail to understand that Islam encourages these things in the Quran and Hadith because Muhammad did all of these things, and it's the basis of Sharia law. It is the primary message of the Quran and the primary message of the Hadith. And when you fail to expose that reality and make those connections and simply bemoan the victim, then from, I think, any moral and rational perspective, you are a lost individual. You're an individual who is adrift without a conscience, without morality, without any form of reference that is productive. So absolutely. So here's the story. It's from the New York Times, and it says that the Islamic State announced that it was bringing back institutionalized slavery. And that's not true. That's just not true. Are they engaged in institutionalized slavery? Absolutely. Have they engaged in slavery from the beginning? That's also true. Are they making public announcements justifying the enslavement of women and children? Yes. But they're not bringing it back. It's always been here. It's always been fundamental to Islam. It's part of Sharia law. It's part of the Quran. It's part of the Hadith. Islam was financed on the basis of two things, and only two things. The first Muslims were not productive. They didn't grow anything. They didn't make anything. They prevailed in using one of the two, using two strategies, one of which Genghis Khan, of course, made famous, and that is plunder. They would attack civilians, and they would rob them. And that is their was their primary means to finance Islam and to finance themselves, stealing. The eighth surah of the Quran is the first official act of the Islamic era, and it is nothing more than a criminal enterprise, stealing the possessions of civilians through the massive amount of force and weaponry. The second means to finance Islam was related to the first. Those individuals that the Muslims did not kill, particularly the women and children, they enslaved. And they either made those slaves work for them, since they were unwilling to work themselves, or they sold them off as slaves. This is how Muhammad built Islam. It's how he lured Muslims into Islam. It's how he recruited jihadists. A jihadist got to keep 80% of what he stole, including the lives of others that he could sell or use as slaves. And then he authorized sex with those slaves, which, if you're dealing with despicable individuals, is a motivation. And so what we are witnessing throughout Islam is nothing more than a continuation of what Muhammad not only did, but what Muhammad sanctioned in the Quran and Hadith. And so this is not bringing back. It's a continuation of slavery justified by Islam. And since an entire infrastructure has been built, warehouses to put the property, which are now little boys and little girls, as slaves. They are now property. And in Islam, Muhammad made that really clear, that women belong to men. And his farewell sermon was despicable. And he told men, the Muslim men, that Muslim women were theirs, that they were no different than a man owning a goat or a camel. That they were just like a domesticated animal, and that if they wanted to starve them, they could do so. If they wanted to lock them up in a closet without light, without freedom, depriving them of those things, they could do so. If they wanted to starve them, they could do so. If they wanted to beat them, they could do so. The basis of Islam: women are property. If you're a Muslim woman and you live in a free society, shame on you. Women are property. So there are warehouses for them, transportation systems, buses, trucks to move them around, viewing rooms so that other perverted Muslims can bid on these sex slaves. And it has all been built to facilitate the trade of women and girls as property. Now, with this being pervasive throughout the Islamic world, and it existing in Saudi Arabia, it existing in Yemen, it existing in Egypt, it existing in the Sudan, it existing in Somalia, it existing in Syria and Iraq, it existing in Indonesia and Malaysia, because of the prevalence of women being considered property and being treated as slaves for sex, is so pervasive in Islam. And because the Quran sanctions these behaviors, because Muhammad himself engaged in these behaviors, he was a pedophile, he was a rapist, he was a slave trader, he was a kidnapper. Because of those things, we have a doctrine, a human institution that is sanctioning and promoting these heinous criminal acts. And we ought not, as a society, tolerate any institution that promotes rape and pedophilia and torture and terrorism and mass murder and kidnapping and the slave trade. And since Islam, in its Quran and Hadith, in its Sharia, promote all of these things, and because Muslims are engaged in doing these things in the name of their wannabe prophet and wannabe God, we ought to, as a society, be opposed to them. We ought to outlaw them. We ought to expose them. We ought to condemn them. We ought to take the time to understand the lone common denominator in these behaviors. Now, just of Yazidis, which are a tiny fraction of Iraqis, and they're Persian Iraqis engaged in the practice of Zoroastrianism, which was the dominant religion of Persia at the time that the first Muslims attacked them and compelled them to either live as veritable slaves, paying debilitating tax and abject humility to and subjugation to Muslims, or die. There have been very few Zoroastrians, but the Yazidis are, and so they, and what's interesting, even more Christian girls, have been taken from their home, have been bused to warehouses, have been stripped, have been brutalized, have been gang raped, and have been sold to other Muslims as sex slaves. It is part of the recruiting of the Islamic State. Now, this says, to handle them, the Islamic State has developed a detailed bureaucracy of sex slavery, including sales contracts that are notarized by the Islamic State-run Islamic courts, all considered good in Islam. Contracts to justify the kidnapping, enslavement, and sale of children for the purpose of sex are being sanctioned by, notarized by, approved by Islamic courts. Now, what do you think? Are the Islamic courts making their decisions based upon the Torah? Are the Islamic courts making their decisions based upon Zohar? Are they using the jurisprudence of the West? Or are the Islamic courts making their rulings, authorizing the kidnap, the enslavement, and the sexual abuse of children based upon Islamic law? Well, that's obvious. It's based upon Islamic law. And what is the basis of Islamic law? There's only two sources of Islamic law: the Quran and Hadith, full stop. And the Hadith, which dictates to Muslims the behavior of Muhammad and the words of Muhammad so that Muslims can follow his example, comprise 99% of the basis of Sharia law. Muhammad's words and deeds, they're found in the Hadith. 99.9% of what Muhammad said and did was perverted, destructive, deadly. He was a pedophile. He was a rapist. He was a mass murderer. He engaged in the slave trade. He kidnapped boys and girls. He engaged in torture, beheadings, assassinations. He declared war on all humankind. He was an avowed liar. When you have a person who not only was a thief, but justified thievery forming the basis of your legal systems, of your Jewish or your jurisprudence, then you have a serious problem. And why isn't the world overtly condemning, exposing and condemning, telling the truth about Islamic courts and Sharia law? And making the connection that it's Islamic courts based on Sharia law, which is based entirely on the words and deeds of Muhammad as they are recorded in the Hadith, justifying this kind of heinous behavior and going from the victim to the perpetrator to the justification for institutionalizing these and legitimizing these horrid and perverted behaviors. It ought to be illegal. It ought to be exposed. It ought to be condemned. This goes on to say the practice has become an established recruiting tool to lure men from deeply conservative Muslim societies. It's luring every fundamental Muslim. If you're a fundamentalist Muslim, you know that Muhammad engaged in these things. He knows that you authorize these things. So if you want to have legalized rape, legalized pedophilia, if that is what trips your trigger, then you're going to be an Islamic jihadist in an Islamic country where these things are not only legal, they're celebrated. So think of the kind of men that this is luring. And to think that the kind of men that this is luring are, as they say, deeply conservative Muslims, fundamentalist Muslims. The more fundamentalist you are as a Muslim, the better Muslim you are, the more likely it is that you are going to be enticed by the prospect of being able to legally enslave and rape little boys and little girls. That's a common denominator. Make the connection. Now, all religions are hypocritical. Now, think of this for a moment. They're lured to the Islamic State under the prospect of being able to acquire a sex slave. And to be able to abuse that sex slave any way they want. To follow the leader of the Islamic State's example, where he had an American girl kidnapped and enslaved, and then he tortured her and raped her repeatedly, saying that I own you, citing Quran verses along the way. That is all condoned, celebrated, encouraged, in a religion where casual sex is taboo and dating is forbidden. Imagine saying that dating is bad, but raping little girls who have been enslaved, destroying them, that's good. Now, a religion capable of inverting morality like that has no place in this world. It's time that we come to understand who Muhammad was, what he had to say, and come to expose and condemn this horrible religion. The next victim may be your son, maybe your daughter. But even if it isn't yours, shouldn't you care about other sons and daughters? A growing body of policy memos and theological discussions, established guidelines for slavery, including a lengthy how-to manual issued by the Islamic State Research and Fatwa Department just last month. What these wannabe journalists at the New York Times didn't bother to tell you is that the theological discussions and the policy memos that established the guidelines for kidnapping children, taking them from their homes forcibly, treating them as if they are animals, housing them in warehouses, putting them on display naked to sell to someone for the express purpose of that person sexually abusing them, that 100% of the policy guidelines and 100% of the theological discussions justifying such heinous behavior come from a singular source, Muhammad, from his Quran, from his Hadith, from his words, from his deeds. And when you fail to make that connection, you're missing the entire story. That's the entire story. There is nothing that's important in this story other than that connection. That Muhammad engaged in these behaviors, that he authorized these behaviors, that he sanctioned these behaviors, and that the reason they can have policy guidelines for slavery and sexual abuse of little children and a theological discussion on them is because of what Muhammad said and did. Now, it goes on to say that that including a lengthy how-to manual issued by the Islamic State and a fatwa, which is a religious decree on this subject, reminds me of the Little Green Book, the rival to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is the Ayatollah al-Sistani of Iran, the head of the Shiites versus now the head of the Sunnis. And he wrote a book called The Little Green Book. And in it, he issues fatwas and offers theological discussions and internal policies establishing the guidelines for pedophilia with babies as young as 2 years old. He offers the guidelines on how to engage in bestiality. He offers guidelines as to how to rob, rape, and steal, all within the context of Muhammad's life and deeds. Now imagine, here is the spiritual leader of Shiite Muslims issuing a book that promotes the guidelines on how to engage in rape and pedophilia and enslaving children for sexual acts, for engaging in bestiality. And here is the leading authority and spokesperson of Sunni Muslims doing exactly the same thing. Where's the world's outcry? Now, I began this by saying that the problem is that we don't engage in hate speech against these destructive and perverted and deadly, even demonic, behaviors. No, instead, we never make the connection with our words. We never express our disdain in our words. We instead resort to the same tactic that they use: death. We go carpet bomb the Islamic State. We go and use our guns and not our words. But I'm here to tell you that every time you use your guns instead of your words to confront an atrocity like this, no one is ever the wiser. No one ever understands. No one can make a moral distinction. And all you create is more death and more carnage. You never resolve the problem, ever. You make it worse. And yet, if instead of bullets and bombs, we wielded evidence through words, we had a reasonable, rational, moral discussion about Islam rather than bombing the Islamic State, then people would come to understand. There would be a sense of morality, of appropriateness, of righteous indignance. We would make a substantial contribution to the safety of children worldwide if we would have a discussion using words, exposing and condemning the cause of these heinous behaviors. But we don't do that. There's something tragically wrong with our response. We not only don't do the right thing, we do the same wrong thing that those that we are hateful of are doing. We become merchants of death. This New York Times article then goes on to say that repeatedly the Islamic State leadership has emphasized a narrow and selective reading of the Quran and other religious rulings to not only justify violence, but also to elevate and celebrate each sexual assault as spiritually beneficial, even virtuous. The second part of that is true. The first part of it is not. They are celebrating. When Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi tortured and raped Kayla, the aid worker, when he is sanctioning the kidnap and rape of Christian girls and Yazidi girls and Shiite girls and boys, when in Pakistan there are thousands of young boys that are being sodomized and filmed and then blackmailed, when they are doing this, they are all celebrating it. It's a spiritual Islamic experience. They are citing the Quran to say that they own these children, that these children exist for their sexual abuse. It is not just that these things are crimes in Islam. The religious experiences in Islam. That's how serious this problem is. But it's not a narrow reading of the Quran and other religious rulings. It's an open and comprehensive reading of the Quran and Hadith. And keep in mind, the Quran is Hadith. It's an oral report from Muhammad and his companions. The Quran and the Hadith was spoken by the same individual to the same people and carried on from mouth to ear, by exactly the same people. It was revealed in the same context by the same individuals chronicling the same events. There's no distinction between the Quran and Hadith. They are both Hadith. Oral reports from Muhammad and his companions. They say the same thing. The only difference between Quran and Hadith is that there are two chronological and contextual Hadith collections, and the Quran is neither chronological nor contextual and a jumbled mess, and therefore the only way for the Quran to be understood is to use the chronological and contextual Hadith to reorder it chronologically and to set it into the context of Muhammad's life. And when you do that, what you find is this is the pervasive message. It's not a narrow reading. There are no statements against enslavement. There are no statements against the having sex with slaves and therefore rape. There are no statements against decapitation. There are no statements against fighting. The Quran is a declaration of war on all humankind. It is a criminal enterprise. It is a terrorist manifesto. That is the dominant reading of the Quran. There is no reading of the Quran that would, in context, would give you any other conclusion. So it would only be an out-of-context, narrow reading of the Quran that would cause someone who was ignorant of the rest of the Quran to suggest that Islam was opposed to kidnap and enslavement and pedophilia and rape, decapitation and jihad. The absolute opposite of what the New York Times reported is true. You know, for example, when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi had his last public sermon, his pronouncement, 100% of what he had to say was quoted out of the Quran and Hadith. All he did is strung hundreds of Quran and Hadith statements together for the purpose of conveying the truth, that according to Allah and Muhammad, jihad is a requirement for all Muslims, and that it requires Muslims to pick up arms and to fight against non-Muslims. And that everything else that he has done and is doing is justified by Muhammad's example, by the Quran and Hadith. Even if the captives are released, this article says, or manage to escape, the trauma doesn't end, given the stigma that is associated with rape victims in conservative societies. God damn. It is just perverse. The lack of journalistic integrity. The commitment to political correctness. Conservative society. This writer is a secular socialist humanist, therefore a liberal. And so they want to blame the victim and say that the consequence here is the reason that the victim is being abused is because the society is conservative. Hell no. The reason the rape victim is being condemned upon return is because the societies have been influenced by the upside-down morality of Islam. In Islam, it is the victim of rape that is punished, not the perpetrator. So this has nothing to do with a conservative society. It has everything to do with an Islamic society, where the victim is the one who is prosecuted. The victim is the one who is jailed. You look at Pakistan, where these boys have been hauled out of their home, kidnapped, and then sodomized and raped and tortured, all on film. And when the parents say that I have proof that my son was sexually abused, that he was blackmailed, and here's the proof, here's the video even of the perpetrators, the police won't go after the perpetrators. No. They'll incarcerate the boy who was victimized. When Muslims find a girl that was raped, they'll stone her to death. Not the victim, not the victimizer. 25 people were killed day before yesterday in clashes between the Islamic State and a rival Muslim group backed by armed civilians in the Libyan city of Sirte in Libya. 25 people killed in Libya in battles between two rival Islamic militias. And they went off to say that the other Islamist group was comprised of armed civilians. What do they think the Islamic State is? I mean, do you think that there are uniforms and officers qualifying and that there are ranks of officers in a military establishment? Are you that naive as to how jihad is perpetrated, about the ranks of mujahideen? These are not armies. 100% of the jihadists fighting on behalf of the Islamic State are civilians. They're all civilians. And so you've got civilians fighting civilians. So to point out that one side is armed civilians, who are fundamentalist Muslims, fighting the Islamic State, who you're presenting as if it were a army, is just incredulous. This goes on to say that women and children were killed in the crossfire as the clashes broke out earlier this week. Well, of course, women and children were killed, because jihadists hide behind women and children. They not only hide behind them, they use them. They, you know, a woman is a less expensive shield than is a bulletproof vest. It's the nature of Islam. They've always done it. They continue to do it. They will always do it. All you have to do is look at the behavior of Hamas in Gaza. Where do they fire their rockets? From schools, from hospitals, from apartment complexes. Why do they do that? Because when Israel retaliates to take out the rocket launchers, there's collateral damage, and the collateral damage is the loss of life of Muslim women and children who don't want to be there, but are told if they leave there, that the Hamas operatives will kill them. They want them to die. Islam is a death cult. It has always been a death cult. But here, the Islamic State is in Libya. Oh boy, we've done a really nice job of confronting the Islamic State. We should applaud the abominator. There was, at most, 10,000 participants in the Islamic State when he declared war on them. And now, look at them. It's the most popular Islamic group in modern history. And they're spreading like a cancer throughout the world. We did a nice job, didn't we? Of that was the Abominator and John McClown teaming together to bomb Libya, to rid Libya of Muammar Gaddafi. That turned out really nice, didn't it? Yeah, that was great. Now all we have throughout Libya is clashes between fundamentalist Islamic groups vying for power. Most of Sirte, the hometown of former leader Muammar Gaddafi, fell to the Islamic State earlier this year. According to the article, the Islamic State is one of a number of groups, of jihadists, battling for control of Libya, and it has made advances across the country. Fighting broke out in a residential area Monday between the Islamic State and a Salafist Muslim group backed by angry armed civilians. You know what Salafist means, don't you, folks? Salafist means ancestor. A Salaf in Islam is a Muslim who pays attention to what the ancestors, the first Muslims, said and did. So, if you were looking for information so that you could know what a Salaf Muslim believed and held as valuable and was going to do, where would you look? That's the Hadith. That's the oral report from the first Muslims. The chronicles Muhammad and the first Muslims' words and deeds. So a Salaf is a Muslim that pays attention to, that believes, that follows the example set in the Hadith. What do we find in the Hadith? That Muhammad and his companions were terrorists. They were mass murderers. They were rapists. They were pedophiles. They were plunderers. They were thieves. That is what we find. So this is a Salafist group against a Salafist group. Fundamentalist Muslims killing fundamentalist Muslims. As a matter of fact, the Islamic State says you either pledge allegiance to our leadership or we will kill you, even though you're a Sunni Muslim.